Okay, Erev Tov. Welcome to the present of the Jews, part 17. This is actually lecture B on Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And we're going to focus tonight on Roosevelt and the Holocaust. Last week was more introductory and dealt with Roosevelt and his interactions with his contemporaries, his Jewish advisors, and domestic affairs. But I want to talk only about the Holocaust tonight. There was another world leader whose term almost exactly paralleled that of FDR, and that, of course, was Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro. Hitler became Chancellor of Germany January 30th, 1933, which was exactly 5 weeks before Roosevelt became president. And Hitler killed himself April 30th, 1945, which was 18 days after Roosevelt died. So Roosevelt's role in the world on the world stage was defined by his relationship with Hitler. That is to say, his dealings before the war, his conduct during World War II, and for our purposes, his actions during the Holocaust, what FDR did or did not do to save the Jews suffering under the Nazi yoke, what he did or didn't do to admit refugees into the United States. And I want to look also at what his Jews were advising him at the time. Hitler and Roosevelt were completely different in background, notwithstanding the careers paralleled each other in this sense. FDR from a patrician upstate New York family, Hitler from a broken, dysfunctional, unhappy home in Austria. He and Eichmann, the unique distinction of attending the same high school in Linz, 17 years apart. FDR educated in the finest schools in America. Hitler uneducated, self-taught, almost died during World War I from poison gas, and unsuccessful in life until he entered politics. FDR, the symbol of optimism and perseverance. Hitler, raging, angry, ranting against injustice, betrayal, Jews. So how odd it is that the course of their lives was so intertwined. Now, we live today with the irony that FDR turned Jews into Democrats for reasons we discussed last week, notwithstanding that his record on Jewish issues is mixed, and on the Holocaust, disconcerting or worse. So what did he do? What didn't he do? How did FDR respond to the rise of Hitler in Germany, to the early attacks on Jews, to Hitler's blustery threats? We know now that FDR had read Mein Kampf, and probably in the original German. How did FDR respond to Germany's violations of the Versailles Treaty? In essence, he didn't. So what, in addition to what he did or didn't do, we should deal with the question, which is also troubling, what could he have done? We should understand, what did he know, and when did he know it, and what did he do about it? Jews idolized him when he died, and for the most part, Roosevelt always said the right thing in public or something close to it. He never evinced callousness or indifference in public, but the sum total of his record is that of callousness and indifference. Or is it? So what could he have done? And that he didn't do certain things, like relax immigration quotas for one, is that attributable only to him? Was it his decision? Or was he in fact not reflecting the consensus of his era? What do the establishment Jews of his time request or demand of him? So Jews always ask a simple question: why didn't he save Jews, any Jews, from the Nazi extermination camps? Why didn't he divert at least some of the military resources at his disposal to save Jewish refugees or prisoners? So I want to be fair before I condemn him. If we wish to be objective, then the question we have to ask ourselves is this: has the United States ever sent its armed forces into harm's way for a purely humanitarian or for humanitarian purpose? And the answer is a qualified yes. Qualified, because I cannot think of a case where the purpose was solely or purely humanitarian. when America has gone on rescue missions, the primary purpose has always been political, to protect some American interest or to achieve some geopolitical goal. And there are unfortunately many cases, old and modern, where the United States did not intervene at all. This was certainly true when the dominant ethos of international relations in America was laissez-faire, non-interference in the internal affairs of other nations. This was the norm until the mid-20th century. We've discussed a lot of the exceptions. Van Buren's protest over the Damascus blood libel in 1840 was an exception, as was Teddy Roosevelt's relatively mild protest about the Kishinev pogrom, also an exception. Buchanan's refusal to get involved in the Mortara affair, like Hoover's refusal to condemn the Chevron massacre, was the norm. So, take it out of our context. Where is the United States when 1 million Armenians were being massacred by the Turks in 1915? Where is the United States when 3 to 4 million Ukrainians were being starved to death by Stalin in the mid-1930s? Where is the U.S. when more than 1 million Bangladeshis were massacred by the Pakistanis in 1971? And bear in mind, we supported Pakistan then. Where is the U.S. when Pol Pot murdered 2 million of his people in Cambodia? And Carter was supporting the Cambodians. Where is the U.S. in Bosnia, or Rwanda, or Darfur, or Kurdistan, etc.? Where has the U.S. been in Syria, where 250,000, maybe 300,000 civilians have been killed in 5 years? So here's the answer. Americans are very kind people with good values who are very equivocal about sending their military forces on purely humanitarian missions in the midst of war zones. So the minig in the United States for more than a century in responding to any massacre of innocents has always been to denounce it, to decry it, occasionally make threats, do nothing, declare never again will this happen when the extent of the horror is revealed, and then do the exact same thing the next time a massacre starts. Again, denounce, decry, make threats, do nothing, and say never again. That's the repeated pattern of American history. There's rhetorical excess, there's impassioned remorse, and there's practical silence. And if not silence, at least practical inaction. Again and again and again. So there's one difference in the Holocaust, not just that it happened to us, but before that, we all have to answer a simple question. Simple question, and I tell you up front, it's not so easy to answer. If we don't here support America intervening to saving Syrian civilians or Kurdish civilians, etc., so what then is the moral or even political argument that could be made that would be critical of FDR saving Europe's Jews? Roosevelt owed no obligation to Europe's Jews, neither did America. And talk of heartlessness, I mean, this only came out, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, in 1973. Golda Meir visited the White House, Nixon was the president, and she made an impassioned plea on behalf of Soviet Jews, and Nixon was thwarted by none other than Henry Kissinger, and this was Kissinger's quote to Nixon, as was recorded, it's actually on tape, as you know. Kissinger said, "The emigration of Jews from the Soviet Union is not an objective of American foreign policy. And if they put Jews into gas chambers in the Soviet Union, it is not an American concern. Maybe a humanitarian concern." End quote. Even that is a maybe. But what Kissinger said is exact, and how he felt is not much different than how Roosevelt felt. Except for the fact, whatever reason, people loved Roosevelt, Jews too, and people did not like Nixon. The sad fact is that FDR's decisions to do nothing or to do little were mostly popular with the American electorate. There was no great movement in America to open American doors to millions of refugees. FDR was acting politically and, of course, duplicitously in telling some Jews one thing and then not following through on it. but he paid no political price for it, not even among Jews, because in fact the only political price he would have had to pay would have been if he had actually done something. Only difference in the Holocaust was the bombing of the crematoria, the rail lines, and the machinery of death, all of which would have involved no diversion of resources because the planes were already flying overhead. Simply put, saving the Jews was not a military or strategic objective of the United States government. And as it would be foolish to state that FDR wanted the Holocaust, it would be equally foolish and incorrect to say that he did anything substantive to halt it or diminish it. He did not. The end of the Holocaust was a collateral benefit of winning the war. What he is guilty of, and this is to the shame of any human being, is gross indifference to the lives of European Jews, and in that he was simply echoing the political reality in the United States, including among substantial elements of Jewish elites. So what did Roosevelt do and what didn't he do? What could he have done? There are four areas to discuss. The initial responses to the rise of Nazism, immigration and refugee relief, both before and during the war, the conduct of the war itself, and including the bombing of the extermination camps and infrastructure. So let's start first, the early responses. As we discussed last week, Roosevelt's first term, really second term, is completely focused on domestic needs to the extent that military spending was slashed and America became essentially, although not widely known, a third-rate military power. How weak? Well, when World War II began, the Polish Navy was larger than the American Navy. Not that it did the Poles any good. Unfortunately, it was a land war. You know, tanks against horses. But nonetheless, America had a powerful navy. It did not in 1939. This focus on domestic affairs dovetailed with the then American tradition of non-interference in the domestic affairs of other nations and the very strong isolationist sentiment that existed in this country. So Hitler became Chancellor of Germany January 30th, 1933, and immediately, I mean the next day, there are pogroms against Jews. Jews were attacked in the streets. In fewer cases, Jews were attacked in their homes by Nazi goons. When Hitler and a smaller party became the majority in the Reichstag in early March, anti-Jewish legislation was quickly passed and anti-Jewish acts intensified. In the U.S., public attention was paid only to the bank crisis, to the painful effects of the Depression. But the diplomats knew. And the American Embassy in Berlin immediately reported on the atrocities. Just 7 weeks after Hitler took power, March 22, 1933, the first concentration camp was opened. Dachau was right outside Munich, which of course was a Hitler stronghold, Nazi stronghold. It was a leading camp for political prisoners, for clergy, for communists. Jews would come later, but you know, in Dachau, most victims of the camp were not Jewish. Dachau is well known to us because so few of the major camps were liberated by the Allies. Most were liberated by the Soviets, and therefore there was just not as much filming or reporting going on about it. But Dachau was liberated by the Allies. When Dachau was opened, the Nazis didn't hide it. All of this was reported, and in the ensuing months as well, the dismissal of Jews from their jobs, the assaults on Jews in the streets, the closing of Jewish stores. What was the official American reaction? Nothing. No protest was lodged to all the pogroms, all the riots, except in response to one incident in which several Jews who are American citizens were beaten up. Then the State Department issued a protest not to harm Americans. The American media across the country reported on all these stories. The government was silent. Secretary of State for most of FDR's presidency was Cordell Hull, who had been a former candidate for president a few times in the 20s, senator from Tennessee, chosen by Roosevelt because he wanted a Southerner, but Roosevelt almost entirely shut out Hull from most foreign affairs. For example, Roosevelt went several times to talk, meet with Churchill or Stalin. He never took his Secretary of State with him. Hull was a stern man. He married late in life, had no children. He was very unsympathetic to Jews, and his aides always defended him to some of Roosevelt's Jewish supporters against charges of Jew hatred by simply whispering, "His wife is Jewish." And indeed, Hull's wife was from an Austrian Jewish family, which was true, but not very relevant to anything. In response to the ongoing pogroms in Germany, Hull said nothing, except that he'll watch the situation, and he added, and I quote, "Outside intercession has rarely produced the results desired and has frequently aggravated the situation." What he didn't care to know was that the Nazis, as the 30s went on, were very sensitive at that stage, and even later, to public or diplomatic protests. Unlike the Muslim terrorists today, the Nazis tried to keep their massacres private, out of public view. This too would serve a double American interest. The government could at the same time refuse to lodge a protest and deflect criticism by saying they need to verify the matters first, because much was not in the open. So when the Nazis announced on April 1st, 1933, they would institute a nationwide boycott of Jewish products, the American Jewish establishment announced on that same day they would begin a boycott of German products. Hull tried to get both sides to back down, but he told the Jews he thinks that accounts of the terror are exaggerated, so therefore the boycott would be counterproductive. Nonetheless, the Jews persisted. A rally against Germany in the spring of 1933 at Madison Square Garden attracted 20,000 people, with 35,000 outside. FDR's government did not send even a representative, even a letter, to this gathering protesting the Nazi brutality against Jews. Al Smith spoke. He'd been the Democratic candidate in 1928. Robert Wagner spoke. He was then a New York governor, as did the Protestant and Catholic bishops of New York City. In the late spring, 1933, Jews were systematically barred from the professions in Germany, law, medicine, etc. Again, there was no official response. And Roosevelt told the new American ambassador to Germany before he left on his new post, June 16, 1933, I quote, "The German authorities are treating the Jews shamefully, and the Jews in this country are greatly excited. But this is also not a government affair. We can do nothing except for American citizens who happen to be victims." And this was government policy, period. Now bear in mind, Roosevelt could count on Jewish support for his passivity as well. The American Jewish Congress led the boycott of German goods, but they were opposed by the American Jewish Committee, who felt that quiet diplomacy was best. And they always opposed, always Jews opposing public protests and demonstrations, always Jews favoring restraint. When Dr. Cyrus Adler, later became the president of JTS, met with Hull and recited to him the list of times the American government had protested treatment of Jewish nationals abroad, going back to Van Buren's time, Hull was noncommittal and even a little turned off, and he promised to keep monitoring the situation. And indeed, the American government monitored the Holocaust for a good 12 years. Formal protests would not be issued until during the war itself. Even then, the protests were muted. And even then, keep in mind, the protests served a propaganda interest of the United States. Government policy under FDR was to take no real interest in the treatment of European Jews, or again, said a different way, to take an interest, but really do nothing about it. And this becomes most clear when we consider American immigration policy during this time. It can't be emphasized enough that the two main barriers to the admission of Jewish refugees was the indifference of Jewish life to many government officials from FDR on down, to the restrictive immigration laws enacted in the 1920s that, whatever we may feel about it, were very popular in America. There was no political upside to relaxing immigration quotas at all. because the Jews voted for him anyway, it was only a political downside. And in fact, there was some immigration. My own family came as refugees in 1939, and so Jews saw that. But the numbers tell a very sorry tale. The quotas, low as they were, went woefully unfulfilled in the 1930s. For example, total quota, immigration quota in 1933 was 150,000 Europeans. Not all Jews necessarily, but Europeans from the European countries. Only 23,000 came, of whom only 1,800 were Germans, meaning that was 120,000, 130,000 slots that were just unfilled. From 1933 to 1943, there were 1.2 million unfilled slots under the quota. That's a lot of people. Each slot ultimately represents a life that was lost. And that's not even considering what would have happened had the quotas been increased on an emergency basis. But the demand for relaxed immigration began immediately after Hitler took over. Frankfurt was one of them at the very beginning. Jews pressured Roosevelt to open the doors a little more. Roosevelt refused. But the point is, even the quotas that existed were not filled. Now, quotas went unfilled for two reasons. They're pejorative reasons, obviously. Too many officials did not like Jews. Hard to imagine why. But in 1939, a Gallup poll showed that almost half the American population felt that Jews had too much influence in government. So there was not a tremendous outcry to bring more Jews into the country. And the quotas went unfilled for bureaucratic reasons as well. And this is where it gets especially irritating in retrospect. So consider this true story. Stories by the thousands. A Jewish refugee escaped Germany in 1941 to a neutral country, was denied a visa to the United States because technically all applicants for visas had to produce a certificate of good behavior for the previous 5 years from the police chief of his hometown. Apparently, Nazi police officers were not in the habit of giving good conduct certificates to Jews in the middle of the Holocaust. So on that basis, Jews will be turned away. If you didn't have the good conduct certificate from the Nazi, your application will be stamped denied on that basis alone, and that's the end of it. If a refugee did not have a job waiting for him or resources to support himself, he was denied on the grounds of being a public charge. And at the same time, already by the mid-1930s, the Germans greatly restricted the amount of money a Jew could take out. So the candle was burnt at both ends. It's not to say the laws were meant to be anti-Jewish. All groups suffered. But in the 1930s depression, the average American did not want refugees coming to compete for jobs or resources. And this continued into the 1940s, even during the war. There were exceptions made, and Jews knew of the exceptions. And because people were coming, they assumed that the regulations were being relaxed. It would take decades to reveal government complicity in barring the door to Jewish refugees. Congressman Martin Dies, Democrat of Texas, was typical, if a little overboard, when these debates were being held in the late 1930s. I quote, "We must ignore the tears of sobbing sentimentalists and internationalists," by that he meant Jews, "and we must permanently close, lock, and bar the gates of our country to new immigration waves, and then throw the keys away." Well, you still hear echoes of that today as well. And if one group would pressure FDR on moral grounds to relax the quotas, and various groups did, another group, like organized labor, would pressure FDR not to do that so as not to create more job competition. Even after Kristallnacht, November 9th and 10th, 1938, schools across Germany burnt down. More than 25,000 Jews arrested, Jews beaten and killed, stores plundered, and then Jews were fined 1 billion marks, it's about $400 million, to pay for the damage the Nazis had done to them. FDR was asked at a press conference that week about relaxing immigration restrictions to help the refugees. especially the German Jews? And he answered, that is not in contemplation. We have the quota system. And even that quota system was so constricted as to leave hundreds of thousands to suffer a cruel fate. What was FDR's response to Kristallnacht? He temporarily recalled the American ambassador to Germany in protest, which happens to be a lot more than the European countries did. They didn't even do that. In May 1938, a conference at FDR's initiative, a conference was convened in Evian, France, to discuss resettlement of Jewish refugees. So for sure, Roosevelt saw the plight of European Jews as a looming disaster, but the American government did not offer to take any more Jews than the quota allowed, and the only country that volunteered to take Jews at the Evian conference was the Dominican Republic, 100,000 in all, but very few Jews were actually able to make it there. And this was a recurring pattern. This was in 1938, the Bermuda Refugee Conference during the height of the war, 1943, had absolutely no achievements except for the illusion sold to the public that something was being done. It was all a show. All of them were just shows because no country wanted to take Jews. In fact, FDR planned these things to look like there was movement, activity, but there was nothing. The Bermuda Conference was so disheartening, it's what pushed Shmuel Ziegelbaum off the edge. Ziegelbaum was the Bundist leader who had escaped the Warsaw Ghetto to bring news of its destruction to the West. He poisoned himself to death in London, May 1943, after hearing that his wife and daughter had been killed in the ghetto. And he left a suicide note that ended, "By my death, I wish to give expression to my most profound protest against the inaction in which the world watches and permits the destruction of the Jewish people." In a cruel irony, the Bermuda Conference opened April 19th, 1943, the very same day the Warsaw Ghetto uprising began. While the diplomats fiddled, the Jews burned. But the public perception of these conferences was that something good had to be happening. Thus, in December 1938, a few months after Evian, Roosevelt was awarded the American Hebrew Medal, a group of Christians and Jews, for taking the initiative in resolving the Jewish crisis, for taking responsibility in putting together the Evian Conference for aiding the refugees of Central Europe. Rarely has perception and reality been so skewed, so distorted, and so antithetical. And FDR, throughout this time, he would meet with Jews and he would toss out ideas. We'll send them to Angola, send them to Cuba, even again and again, we'll get back to this, to the land of Israel. But once the Jews left, there was never any follow-through. And these suggestions even came out based on who he was talking to at any particular moment. So, typical of the cold-heartedness was the voyage of the St. Louis, which left Hamburg in May 1939, just 3 months before World War II started. So it's 936 passengers all bound for Havana, all with Cuban landing certificates. Hundreds had American visas as well, but Cuba's president invalidated the visas, which may have been fraudulent to begin with, even though they paid money for it. The ship docked in Havana. Most of the passengers were not allowed to disembark, and within a week, they were told to leave Havana Harbor. Offers to increase the bond they had all paid were rejected. They sailed north without any final destination in mind. In the U.S., the JDC, the Joint Distribution Committee, took up their battle, and despite their best efforts, were unsuccessful. A telegram by the passengers was sent to Roosevelt. No response. The ship headed towards Florida, and the U.S. Coast Guard fired warning shots. Henry Morgenthau Jr., the Treasury Secretary, became involved, trying to convince Hull to accept the ship, even have the refugees temporarily stay in the Virgin Islands. That too was rejected. Agavurcha, in 1940, when another proposal was raised to turn the Virgin Islands into a refugee haven, the American government, this is Hull again, and Breckinridge Long will get to, responded by declaring the Virgin Islands a closed military zone. Just arbitrarily, but this way no civilians can go there at all. The St. Louis sailed back to Europe. One Jewish refugee who had been imprisoned at Buchenwald slit his wrists and jumped overboard to his death. Some passengers found refuge in England, most on the continent. Of those who made it back to the continent, mainly Belgium and Western Europe, about a third were murdered in the Holocaust. Now, it was never lost on Hitler that the Allies, especially the Americans, did not especially care about the plight of Jewish refugees, or cared, but not enough to do something about it. And after Evian, Hitler boasted, if the world has such deep sympathy for these criminals, he'll be happy to put them all on luxury ships and ship them to these countries. But of course, it never happened. Arab riots in 1936 in Israel dissuaded the British from opening the land of Israel to Jewish immigration, or further Jewish immigration. And imagine this, October 28th, 1936, Roosevelt spoke at the 50th anniversary of the dedication of the Statue of Liberty, and was urged to use the occasion to speak about the plight of Jewish refugees. Can't have a better setting for it. New York City, the largest population of Jews in the world in one city. They're in the audience. Most of the Jewish immigrants had passed the Statue of Liberty. Roosevelt declined. And his speech was filled with flowery praise of the United States as a beacon for those who seek liberty. But it was so hollow at the time and so unctuous compared to the reality then prevailing that it's actually revolting to read his speech. He knew what he was saying was a complete falsehood. One of the first books published in this genre was in the late 1960s, a book by Arthur Morse entitled While 6 Million Died, A Chronicle of American Apathy. And it's a little less than a quarter century after Roosevelt's death, and the book was an eye-opener. And one point he makes over and over is that anyone who says they did not know what the Nazis were doing is either lying or was just not interested in knowing. Even the New York Times chronicled the mistreatment of Jews in the 1930s and the plight of the refugees. Their concealment of the Holocaust would not start until the 1940s. They reported on it, but it was always buried in the middle of the paper. But the media was always replete, the Times exception in that sense, across the country. The media was replete with accounts of Nazi brutality on the one hand, and the bureaucratic indifference to the refugees on the other. All right, honorable mention should go to a number of people. One, James McDonald, was the High Commissioner for Refugees for the League of Nations in the mid-1930s. He actively tried to help Jews. When he left the League, Roosevelt brought him into administration, but again, as a fig leaf. And he, McDonald, enlisted the support of American Jewish groups after he left the League. Another was Frances Perkins, famous as the first female cabinet secretary. She also was only one of two cabinet secretaries to serve the entire Roosevelt administration, 12 years as Secretary of Labor. Harold Ickes was the Interior Secretary for that period also. So from her perch at the Labor Department, really not directly connected to this, she was so dedicated to saving Jewish refugees, people routinely accused her of being Jewish. But they all ran into a roadblock called the State Department. The Germans invaded Poland September 1st, 1939, and Britain and France both pledged to defend Poland, declared war, World War II was on. The U.S. at the time was bound by the Neutrality Acts passed by Congress in the 1930s that barred aid or the sale of arms to belligerent countries, all in line with the isolationist tendencies of that period. Part of it was repealed in 1940, and arms sales were permitted on a cash and carry basis. And this itself was further modified by FDR a year later by his Lend-Lease plan with the British. The British would be aid with munitions and it could pay for it later, the layaway plan. So what happened? FDR was very supportive of Britain, but he's primarily a political creature. By March 1939, almost 80% of Americans supported providing food aid to Britain and France should war break out. essentially undoing the very purpose of the Neutrality Act. So Roosevelt read the polls, and he saw that now was a time when the hatred of Germany had so increased, he would start aiding, on a modest basis, the Western European countries. Jews were less successful with Roosevelt. Steady reports in the media about the atrocities against the civilian populations of Europe once the war broke out, especially Jews, and especially when the systematic executions perpetrated by the Einsatzgruppen began in the summer of 1941. Hundreds of thousands of Jews shot to death in the western part of the Soviet Union. But this is well known. It was reported on by the media. It was no official American acknowledgement or protest. And even worse than that, you get to the heart of the callousness. August 1st, 1942, Gerhard Regner, who was the Swiss representative of the World Jewish Congress, came into possession of documents. He was given documents from a leading German industrialist, a Nazi who nonetheless was not supportive of Hitler. Now we know his name, Edward Schulte. The documents were Nazi documents that showed that Hitler was planning the extermination of the Jews of Europe, including a report that the method of massacre would be the use of Zyklon B, the gas that would murder Jews in Auschwitz, whose extermination chambers were then under construction. So August 1942, probably a little less than half of European Jews had already been massacred, but a majority was still alive. Within weeks, Regner had received other confirmations, and he met in August with the American vice consul in Geneva, gave him a cable to send to superiors and to be given to Rabbi Stephen Wise, saying in brief, and again, August 1st, 1942, so a little less than 3 years to go in the war, maybe 2 years and 9 months. This was his telegram. Received alarming report that in Führer's headquarters, plan discussed and under consideration, according to which all Jews in countries occupied or controlled Germany, numbering 3.5-4 million, excluding USSR, should after deportation and concentration in East be exterminated at one blow to resolve once and for all the Jewish question in Europe. Again, Holocaust has won 2.5 years left when this news was sent to the State Department. And again, July 1942, most European Jews still alive, although the death camps at Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor were up and running. The American diplomat in Geneva was shocked, but he sent the cable, which was suppressed by the State Department, they said, out of disbelief. Now, the point was the state should notify Stephen Wise, who was the acknowledged Jewish leader at the time. And no, why was it sent through these methods? Because you couldn't just use Western Union. You had to send through secret or private diplomatic channels. You know, they weren't as swift then about using email on open servers. So you had to do it in private. Well, the cable was not forwarded to Wise for almost 4 months until November. But worse than that, Regner had sent a similar cable through British diplomatic channels at the same time, and so Wise had the information already in August, long before State informed him, and he too sat on it, meeting with Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells, who told him in August to say nothing until the U.S. could confirm what was happening. When Wells got confirmation, he actually became one of the few State Department officials to actively help Jewish refugees, and for that he was blackmailed into resigning his position because he had homosexual tendencies that he acted upon. So in fact, he left government service a little over a year and a half later. In August, Regner later wrote, he was in agony, because he sent this word and nothing was happening. And State had officially informed him it would not notify Wise until they could verify the information. By this time, thousands of Jews were being murdered each day. In September 1942, this is 2 months later, Myron Taylor, the American ambassador to the Vatican, filed reports to the State Department that Jews were being deported in cattle cars from Germany, Belgium, France, the Netherlands, Slovakia, to points east, fate unknown. The Vatican said it could be of no help, but again, the State Department was silent. In November, Wells confirmed to Wise that atrocities were taking place, and Wise decided to seek out Roosevelt's help. What he didn't know was that the British, in August, in their response to Regner's first report, had decided to publicize a war crimes commission to prosecute Nazi war criminals after the war was over, but the British could not get Roosevelt to endorse the formation of that commission for many months for reasons that remain inexplicable, although we could guess. American support wasn't announced until October 1942 in a brief statement by FBR that the number of such war criminals they would prosecute would, I quote, would obviously be very small. Meaning he meant just the top leadership and none of the people actually carrying out the genocide. By the way, the very word genocide arose this time, was invented that year, 1942, by a Jewish lawyer named Raphael Lemkin, who had fought in the Polish army, wounded, escaped through Sweden to the U.S., geno meaning a race or a people, side of course homicide, murder of a race. Why sent a letter to FDR December 2nd, 1942, which stands out for its obsequiousness? Dear boss, that's what he called him. I do not wish to add an atom to the awful burden which you are bearing with magic, and as I believe, heaven-inspired strength at this time. But you do know that the most overwhelming disaster of Jewish history has befallen Jews in the form of the Hitler mass massacres. And it's indisputable that as many as 2 million civilian Jews have been slain. All Wise asked was that Roosevelt meet a delegation of Jewish leaders, and he did. It would be the only time during the Holocaust that Roosevelt would meet with a group of Jews outside his inner circle. FDR met them on December 8th, and he used the line that he would use throughout the Holocaust: the best way to help Europe's Jews would be for the U.S. to win the war as quickly as possible. To himself, Wise later wrote, he wondered if any Jews would still be alive to enjoy the fruits of victory, but he said nothing. On December 17th, 1942, for the first time, the Allies condemned the Nazi extermination of the Jews, but they did nothing about it, even when they had the opportunity. So, for example, in 1940, a refugee ship, Escape France, was turned away from Mexico and showed up in Norfolk, Virginia, the port there. Jewish leaders, including Nachum Goldman, met with Cordell Hull and asked that these Jewish refugees be admitted. Hull pointed to the American flag behind him and said he had sworn an oath to uphold the laws of the United States and these people lack visas for entry. Goldman, he lived a long life, he had a very prickly personality, told Hull that, you know, just a few weeks earlier, anti-Nazi German soldiers had jumped ship in New York Harbor and the Coast Guard picked them up to prevent them from drowning. So he said, why don't I inform these Jewish refugees they should just jump overboard? Then the Coast Guard will have to pick them up. Hull got angry and he said to Goldman, you are the most cynical man I have ever met. And Goldman responded, I ask you, Mr. Secretary, who is the cynical one? I who wish to save these innocent people, or you who are prepared to send them back to their death? For that, they were kicked out of his office. But indeed, in this particular case, the refugees were saved only through the direct intervention of Eleanor Roosevelt. Sadly, the State Department was populated with people like Cordell Hull, who was indifferent, and others like Breckinridge Long, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, the Undersecretary of State for Refugee Affairs, who was actively and overtly hostile to Jews. So he was the guy who insisted on enforcing all the arcane and sometimes idiotic visa requirements. It was Long who objected to opening the Virgin Islands to Jewish refugees and pleaded with FDR to side with him against Harold Ickes, and FDR did, rebuking Ickes, who was the Secretary of Interior, and telling Ickes to stay out of refugee affairs. In a conference in 1944, Morgenthau would openly call Long anti-Semitic to his face. January 1943, Regner again reported that up to 6,000 Jews a day were being murdered in Poland. Wise was told, he was prepared to announce this at a mass rally at Madison Square Garden, and he was told by the State Department not to do so. And Regner's American contact in Geneva was then told not to accept any more reports from Regner or any other private citizen. The rally at the Garden was standing room, more than 70,000 people outside. Even the Archbishop of Canterbury spoke, 1943 we're talking about, and called the extermination of Jews the most appalling horror in recorded history. The American government was silent, issuing the occasional statement of condemnation, how such cannot be allowed to happen, even as they allowed it to happen. And the story was the same, month after month, myriad of murdered Jews after myriad of murdered Jews, and the refrain was repeated endlessly, we must win the war, we must win the war. And part of winning the war, Roosevelt felt, was not to make the war about saving Jews. And a bigger part, from the Jewish perspective, was about showing unconditional support for Roosevelt. So did Wise and the Jewish establishment. And Roosevelt knew well how to play a double game. In public, he was supportive, because it helped demonize the Nazis. In private, he did not much care. In fact, going back earlier, 1938, Roosevelt had said to Wise that the reason why Jews are hated in Poland is that they dominate the economy. So you can't really blame the Poles. Consider again the Moscow Declaration issued October 1943 by all the Allies, denouncing Nazi genocide, mentioned all the groups they were massacring, did not mention the Jews by name. Most of the Jews who surrounded FDR as advisors were of little help during the Holocaust, for a variety of reasons. Just even one example, there was a non-Jew, Chassidei Umot HaOlam, Jan Karski, a member of the Polish resistance. He was smuggled in and out of the Warsaw Ghetto, made his way to America, report on that. Report on the extermination of Belzec, on the Holocaust, July 1943. In the U.S., he met with Felix Frankfurter, representing FDR, and Frankfurter was skeptical. He said to FDR, I didn't believe him. Later, Frankfurter would write, I did not say he was lying. I said I could not believe him. There's a difference. How lawyerly is that? Karski then met with FDR, who told him to report back to Poland. It's a long statement, but the gist of it was, justice and freedom shall prevail. You will tell your nation you have a friend in this house. And when two groups outside the Jewish establishment began to work in active and vociferous ways, defying the government, the establishment Jews sided with the administration and tried to marginalize these groups. One was the Orthodox Vat HaHatzalah, and the second was known loosely as the Bergson Group, founded and sustained by Peter Bergson, the classic Jewish activist, a real name Hillel Cook. He was Rav Cook's nephew. He used the alias as not to cast aspersions on the Cook name, because he didn't care about doing that, things that were illegal. His committee was called technically the Emergency Committee for the Rescue of European Jewry. Both groups, and they did work together at times, were passionate about one thing, saving Jewish lives, period. They had no other calculations, no big picture, no long term. They were focused on saving Jewish lives. They didn't care about Roosevelt's reputation. They didn't care about their access to Roosevelt. The rabbinical group, the Vat HaHatzalah, focused on smuggling money into Europe to sustain Jews in hiding, to use for bribes when necessary, despite the fact that such was a violation of Jewish law. And you should know, years ago I heard this story, they didn't care. There was one Rav who's confronted by the Treasury Department and threatened with arrest for sending money into a war zone, which is a federal crime. And he said, "You can arrest me and send me to prison. And when I come out, I'll do the exact same thing again." And we know from the Vadat Sala, if there was a chance to do something, anything, there'd be Michal Shabbos to do it. The numerous stories of Rav Aaron Cutler and others, Yaakov Rosenheim, sending Jews on Shabbos in cabs around the city to raise money for this or that particular, going to D.C. on Shabbos if they thought it would be helpful. Bergson, among other things, put ads in newspapers critical of American government apathy, and that had never happened before. FDR was apoplectic. In fact, it was Bergson was told this by Eleanor Roosevelt, who was supportive of Jewish relief efforts more than her husband was. So she told Bergson that Roosevelt complained to her that some of the ads were below the belt and made him angry. So Peter Bergson told her, "I'm sorry he's angry, but I'm glad that I at least got his attention." And in fact, he did. It was Bergson who organized the big rally at the Garden March 9th, 1943, with a play that was presented entitled "We Will Never Die." And it was presented in a number of cities to large crowds, but it was panned by the Jewish establishment, who told people not to attend and not to listen to him. It was Bergson who arranged the big rabbis' rally in Washington right before Yom HaKippurim, October 6, 1943. Who attended? Young rabbis named Moshe Feinstein, Yosef Soloveitchik, the Boyana Rebbe, Rav Avram Kalmanovitz, Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, Rabbi Charles Kahana, father of Meir, Rav Naftali Kalbach, father of Shlomo, 400 rabbis in all. Needless to say, no non-Orthodox rabbis participated. Rav Eliezer Silva read a proclamation in Hebrew in the name of the people there. Rav Aaron David Burak, who was a Rebbe at Reitz, read it in English. And the group marched on the mall reading while reciting Tehillim. They met with Speaker Rayburn. They met with Vice President Henry Wallace. They were told that FDR was out of town or he would meet with him. It was a lie. Roosevelt was in the White House most of the day, where he sneaked out the back, but he was advised not to meet with this group. Stephen Wise belittled them. Beards, old men. Sam Rosenman, who had been Roosevelt's speechwriter going back to 1928, now as the White House counsel, told FDR that he had tried to keep the horde from storming Washington, but was unsuccessful. And he reassured him that the group behind this petition did not represent what he called the most thoughtful elements in Jewry, and that the leading Jews of his acquaintance opposed this march on the Capitol. Rosenman's been back in the news recently. You know why? Obama nominated Merrick Garland to be the new Supreme Court justice. May not happen. He'd be the fourth Jew on the court. Are there any Gentile legal scholars in America left that they can only have Jews? Merrick Garland is married to Sam Rosenman's granddaughter. She's been back in the news. Other Jews, Congressman Saul Bloom of Brooklyn, opposed the march, calling it undignified. According to one report, FDR asked a leading Jew what could be done to liquidate Bergson. That's how angry it made him, because that was the bad publicity that he abhorred. Now, the Bergson group, they're all revisionists. They continued their activities after the war. It was that group that purchased the Altalena, sent it to Israel with arms, and Hillel Cook himself served in the first Knesset as a member of Chirut, but he had a falling out with Begin pretty quickly. See, he was a maverick. See, Hillel Cook died in Israel 2001, lived a long life. Now, what could have happened? What could FDR have done? What are some of the possible actions? Well, in America, nothing changed at all until early 1944. The Rabbi's March had some effect, but something else was brewing. Another, the Hasidim Umos HaOlam, in this story was a young lawyer, special assistant to Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr., named Josiah Dubois. Morgenthau, in fact, from the late 30s on, had a surge in his Jewish identity, and he was aroused to do something to help his brethren, even occasionally drawing criticism from FDR for overstepping his authority. And even he had to put up with constant attacks from others that he's only doing because he's a Jew. And it's a mistake to have a Jew. He was the only Jew in the cabinet. It's a mistake to have him because he cares more about Jews than about Americans. At Morgenthau's request, Dubois drafted a secret memorandum that was presented to FDR, entitled, and if you read the book, While 6 Million Died, this is the cover. Dubois' report was entitled, Report to the Secretary on the Acquiescence of This Government in the Murder of the Jews. Tough words. It was a devastating chronicle of the American government's inaction and, in many cases, obstruction of efforts to save Jews. Now, Morgenthau, of course, was a social friend of Roosevelt as well from Hyde Park, so he had to water down the title when he presented to him. It was just called Personal Report to the President. But nonetheless, it had a devastating effect on Roosevelt. One doesn't have to be a cynic to note that 1944 was an election year, and FDR did not want any reports of the apathy of the American government to reach the public, and it didn't. And again, Roosevelt in that election would win 90% of the Jewish vote in his fourth term victory. Morgenthau told Roosevelt that if nothing was done substantial, Dubois was ready to resign, call a press conference in Washington outlining the government's inaction and obstruction. Under pressure, Roosevelt formed what's called the War Refugee Board, WRB, over the objection of the State Department, where now Undersecretary Edward Stettinius, who later that year replaced Hull, also had no use for long. Hull was ill and was marginalized. It was quick damage control. The group met with FDR, gave him the report January 16th. The War Refugee Board was formed on January 22nd, 6 days later. Its executive director was a non-Jew, John Pell, who's a dynamo. And the group reported directly to Roosevelt, which was Morgenthau's request, because he knew already how state would thwart everything. Even the Secretaries of State and Treasury were nominal members of the board. In all, the WRB saved almost 200,000 Jews, mainly Romanian and Hungarian Jews. Many were saved via Turkey through the work of a U.S. diplomat there, Ira Hirschman, a Jew. They bought freedom for 70,000 Jews at one point. The WRB also funded the work of Raoul Wallenberg in Budapest. The board smuggled almost 1,000 Italian Jews to Canada and then to the U.S. The joint raised $20 million to be distributed through the WRB in Europe. The main point was that something was happening, and certainly more could have been done had such a committee of dedicated people been set up 2 years earlier. There are always Nazis who are susceptible to bribes and also to threats of post-war retribution. And every person involved in rescue, from Schindler to the War Refugee Board, knew it. And Pell exploited this, and the board never consisted of more than 30 people. 30 people in less than a year able to save 200,000 Jews. In March 1944, the board even got Roosevelt to issue a public statement condemning the mass murder of Jews, naming Jews. And leaflets would drop throughout Germany threatening retribution against any accomplices. And the War Refugee Board also worked with Angelo Roncalli, later to be Pope John XXIII, to save Jews from Central Southern Europe. What gets a lot of attention today was not widely entertained during the war itself, and that's bombing the death camps, the gas chambers, the railway lines leading to it, and it was been in the area. Knows the Nazis chose Auschwitz intentionally. It's a major railway hub in the southern part of Poland. Even today, I was astounded when I saw it. About 20 rail lines from every part of Poland that intersect in the town of Auschwitz. Apparently it was John Pell who was one of the first to raise this proposal. because already beginning in the spring of 1944, Hungarian Jews were being liquidated by the hundreds of thousands shipped from Hungary north to Poland. So Pell said, why not bomb the railway lines leading from Hungary? Because if they have no transportation, they can't kill them. This has been suggested to him by the Várad Szalló, and it was consistently shot down for reasons that, in retrospect, are bizarre, ironic, or pitiless. It was John McCloy of the War Department who became notorious for his refusal even to consider it. Why not? Well, it was held alternatively that the government could not divert resources from the war effort. This was bogus because the Americans had already bombed a rubber factory less than 5 miles from Auschwitz, and other factories were also flying overhead in any event. There were even reports now after the war that Jewish inmates at Auschwitz would see Allied planes flying overhead and begin to rejoice, but it just flew right past the camps, nothing. The argument was made that if they acted directly on behalf of Jews, it would bolster the Nazi claim that the war is all about Jews, or that they lack precision bombers to get it right. Difficult to accept reason is this. The advocates were told that they might kill some civilian prisoners in the camp by accident, and therefore they don't want to do it, which is quite irrelevant because by 1944, thousands daily were being massacred. Even a disruption of a week, a month, hitting rail lines, hitting a crematorium, a gas chamber, would have saved thousands, tens of thousands of Jews. This is, again, Hungarian Jews are coming. Eventually, 700,000 were murdered. At one point, McCloy said that Auschwitz is the Soviets' responsibility because they're the ones fighting there. Years later, McCloy in his memoirs wrote that Sam Roseman had told him that FDR was against bombing the crematoria. We don't know if it's true or not. Some apologists note that if the gas chambers had been destroyed, the Nazis would have still murdered Jews by shooting them. They'd done that before. But the Nazis relied on deception to take Jews off the trains, especially then, directly to their deaths. Mass shootings might have provoked more resistance and certainly would not have yielded the same grisly toll. And of course, consider, shooting was less efficient than gassing. That's why they switched from shooting to gassing in the first place. To bomb the rail lines in Hungary, forget Auschwitz, would have been a great disruption. However we look at it, it was never seriously considered in real time during the Holocaust, nor was such a request made by the establishment Jews who had FDR's ear. He simply would have said, we must win the war, we must win the war, we can't divert resources, and they would have accepted it. And the major establishment Jewish groups, WISE, both AJCs, and others, never even made the request. One other point, FDR constantly flirted with the idea of demanding that the British open up the land of Israel to Jews, but at the same time he spoke of his fears that those Jews would just be massacred by the Arabs. And if FDR pushed a pro-Zionist line, there was a fear that the Arabs would support the Nazis, in some cases even more than they already were, and thereby impair the war effort. So this option was never pursued seriously. And again, he played a double game. Roosevelt in private supported the establishment of a Jewish state after the war, but to the Jews, he'd said that to the Jews, to the anti-Zionists, to the Arabs, Roosevelt would say exactly what they wanted to hear. As an example, the story came out recently. Rafael Madoff, who runs the David Wyman Center, told this tale, just released, at Yalta, when FDR told Stalin that he was soon to meet with Ibn Saud, Saudi Arabia fame, the Arabian king. Stalin asked FDR what concessions he was planning on making to Ibn Saud. And Roosevelt said only one. He would offer Ibn Saud America's 6 million Jews. Stalin thought that was a real knee slapper. But the point is, Roosevelt knew how to ingratiate himself with the listener, tell the listener what he wanted to hear, whether that listener was a Jew or anti-Jewish. When he did meet with Ibn Saud, even Roosevelt was taken aback by the Arab's vicious hatred for Jews. And Roosevelt tried to tell him of the indescribable horrors of the Jews in Europe. And Ibn Saud suggested, you know what, give the Jews the best German homes after the war. Punish the Germans. To Ibn Saud, he told Roosevelt, Jews had no claim to the land of Israel. It was all based on fraud and lies. They were never there. It's Arab land. And that the Jews just wanted to exterminate the Arabs. To him, it's a refrain you still hear in the Arab world today, the Holocaust was a European problem. And to quote Ibn Saud to FDR, what injury have the Arabs done to the Jews of Europe? Let the Germans pay. And the fact that oil had just been discovered in Arabia, lots of it, tempered FDR's enthusiasm to do anything. All right, just to summarize, the Holocaust was a catastrophe, obviously. And in some sense, it was unavoidable. But it's hard to escape the conclusion that Jews in the hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, could have been saved had Jewish life been prioritized. It wasn't. Certainly Jewish leadership was woefully inadequate, just not up to the task. The Jewish groups fought amongst each other as well, often not cooperating, with open warfare between the Zionist and non-Zionist groups, and occasionally between the religious and the secular groups. There's a lot of ego involved. And a few people treasured their relationship with Roosevelt so much, they did not want to endanger their access by speaking truth to power. Wise would yet be called by his rival, Rabbi Abba Hillel Silver, a more right-wing Reform rabbi, a classic court Jew, for Wise's blind support and defense of FDR. The fawning over FDR did reach pathetic levels, but Jews became so wedded to him, so convinced of his righteousness and caring, that most Jews since then, say it however, take it however you want, have been surgically attached to the Democrat Party ever since Roosevelt's time. When FDR died, April 12, 1945, last words before a cerebral hemorrhage, I have a terrific headache, which also makes sense. He died in the company of his mistress, Lucy Rutherford. Jews were distraught. Eulogies went overboard in describing FDR's qualities, his love of humanity, his love of Jews, his support of Judaism. Rabbinical Assembly, conservative, called him an immortal leader of humanity and a peerless servant of God. Well, the study of FDR's role during the Holocaust is ongoing. New information is being uncovered all the time. The classic works, I'll mention David Wyman's The Abandonment of the Jews, are being supplemented, revised, updated, and challenged. Books that rehabilitate or defend FDR have also been written. Personally, I think his reputation was buttressed for two decades after the war, after his death, by Eleanor, who became an activist for black rights and very pro-Israel as well. And the assumption was she was just continuing his policies. She wasn't. She was her own woman, died 1962, admired by almost everyone. Roosevelt had to overcome the reluctance of the American people to admit refugees en masse. He never did, but he barely made the effort. He did win the war that ended the Holocaust, but for 6 million Jews, if not more, it was a Pyrrhic victory. And the war was not fought, it was never fought, with the objective of saving Jews. How familiar is Roosevelt's approach? Well, just last week, an article in the Atlantic trying to rationalize Obama's foreign policy failures. And you had this quote. Consider, Obama generally does not believe a president should place American soldiers at great risk in order to prevent humanitarian disasters, unless those disasters pose a direct security threat to the United States. He's no different than FDR. The question is, are we? Roosevelt remains an enigma. For someone so lionized by Jews, his record is uncomplimentary. In terms of prejudice, he was better than most. For someone admired as a strong leader, he refused, always refused, to take politically unpopular positions. For someone lauded as a humanitarian, he did almost nothing to ameliorate the Jim Crow laws in the South. It would have cost him political support. He incarcerated thousands of Japanese American citizens and was upheld by the Supreme Court in Korematsu for doing it. And he maintained segregation in the military. Irony, that would only end by the executive order of Harry Truman. Truman, who had little good to say about Jews in private and harbored the typical racist sentiments of a Southerner, would end segregation in the military and defy expectations and endorse the establishment of the State of Israel. For all FDR was, and for all he really wasn't, it was Truman who overcame political opposition and acted in unpopular and politically suicidal ways to help the Jewish people. His courage will stand out in a way that FDR's indifference still, for most Jews, does not. Next week, Harry Truman, I thank you all very much for coming.